You know, special music, it's my little bugaboo, is not a performance. It is a time of reflection. And I think sometimes we need to always remind ourselves of that. I don't know. I try to say, well, what was the sermonette about? And sit here and reflect, you know, reflect on faithfulness and reflect on what it takes to be faithful. And so I'm sitting there listening to Liz and Sharon play through, you know, a piece that goes forward and back and the melody goes here and there. It's fascinating, right? And that's what faith is. Faith takes a lifetime to build. Faith takes a series of events. It takes others of faith to encourage you along the way. And so that's why we all come to church, you know, not just to learn, but to look into each other's face and remember that person and what they do with life and what they need in life. It's really fascinating. Valerie and Laurel are not with us today. They're out in Redlands. Speaking of faith, there's going to be a baptism out there with a friend. And so technically, I don't think I can say a baptism, right, Ted, before it happens. So we'll have to wait till next week so you know who got baptized out there. But Mr. Weber was using the opportunity while he was there in a baptismal pool to kind of bring it all together. And as I think about faithfulness from the sermonette, Mrs. Helge came and gave me a note reminding me, and I stopped to see Mary Williams the other evening, and I think we were debating whether we would say anything, and if Mrs. Helge brought it to me again, I said, okay, fine. Twice in one day, I should say something. But Mary is now, over the last about 3 or 4 days, on her oxygen 100% of the time. Her disease with her lungs just makes them go up and down. I mean, she's using, you know, she uses, you know, a couple thousand calories a day just to breathe, let alone trying to intake enough to survive. So if we could remember Mary in prayer, I think she would like to, you know, be able to breathe without the oxygen tank. She has a daughter getting married in August, and she would like to be able to go down the aisle, not in a wheelchair, not with an oxygen tank behind her. So, you know, Mary and her tenacity, and just a wonderful, wonderful person of faith over the years. And so I just thought I would be remiss if we didn't mention that. So if you'll turn over with me to James chapter 1, verse 19. There's a great injunction offered by the disciple, the apostle James. James 1, verse 19. And it says, "So then, you dirty, no good scoundrels." Oh, so you're reading, you're comparing what I say to the Bible. This is great. Good news. What's it say, Norma? What's it say? It says, "So then, my beloved brethren," we refer to each other, people of faith, people who've been given that faith by God, nothing less than God. "But beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, and slow to wrath." The Greek word for hear is akouou, akouyo. It literally means to hear, as to not be deaf. The definition expands to mean to hear and to comprehend, to understand, to hear, to comprehend, to understand. Does listening really require action? Most of the time, I think we would say, the answer we think is no. We think it's easy to listen. Turn over with me to Psalm chapter 10, verse 17. Psalm 10, verse 17. David writes the following. We don't have as many electronic devices in the room today. I hear all the pages turning. Sometimes I don't know when to begin. You know, when we go to the feast and we're overseas, everybody takes their electronic Bibles, right? And they don't take real Bibles. And so you go, are they there yet? You know, so I have to have somebody in the back go, yeah, we're there. You know, we're with you. Okay, so Psalm 10 verse 17. "Lord, you have heard the desire of the humble. You will prepare their heart. You will cause your ear to hear." David says God's going to cause, in some situations, his ear to hear. My point today is that hearing is active. That hearing takes technique. That hearing, as in active listening, takes work. It takes a desire. I've given you a handout today. I want to talk about active listening, really getting to know what another person thinks, how to fellowship like your life depended on it. Well, that's the byword I get to take from this book. The book is Never Split the Difference, and it was written by Chris Voss with Tile Raz, and Chris was an international FBI hostage negotiator. And his subtitle is Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It. Imagine, he says, when you're an international hostage negotiator, you can't split the difference. You need somebody alive. So how do you communicate? You say, well, I'll tell you what. You got five hostages, I'll take 2.5. Well, you take 2. How about 3? No, you want them all. We want the whole story with each other, is my point. We want to know what each other think, right? Because if we know what each other think, then we are actively listening. Then we know somebody, and we can know how to pray for them. We can know of their faithfulness. We can know of the sincerity of the walk with God, and it changes who and what we are. Active listening is my point today. For example, a few questions. If I come up and I say to you, when did you start attending church? August 16th, 1978. That's a specific answer, right? I say, oh, what year were you baptized? Somebody in this room might say 60, 70 years ago, right? And they have a specific date. But if I say to you, how did you come to worship and fellowship with here at the United Church of God? Oh, there's a story behind that. You can't give one-word answers. Or how about, what events led you to be baptized? Active. You're asking a calibrated question, we would say. The question we have before us is, do we hear or do we listen? Active listening. How do you do that? I submit to you, Mr. Voss brings up in his book, as a hostage negotiator, he would ask calibrated questions, open-ended questions. He labels people's feelings, and he mirrors their words. Those are the three things we want to talk about today. A quote from Mr. Voss's book, which is fascinating. He's a fascinating author because he's got great stories, right? I mean, when life's on the line, right, and you win, I mean, it's just great, right? I mean, you know, they're in the Philippines and they're negotiating with an international terrorist, and how do they get the people out? And they want $500 million, but no, we're going to give them $2 million. No, we don't buy terrorists. I mean, he's got great stories, right? So it's a great book to bring you along. But he says, the art of asking questions, labeling feelings, and mirroring allow people to express and elaborate on the topic at hand. Negotiating as if your life depended on it encourages us all to be better at asking questions, which encourage dialogue. As a former international hostage negotiator for the FBI, he offers this incredible approach because, you see, after the disaster of Waco, he says the FBI said, well, look, going in with guns blazing clearly didn't work. He said, we had to go get in touch with our softer side. How do we talk to people? How do we get inside the bank robber who's in the bank with five hostages? We got to talk to him. We have to understand what we don't know and see if we can change the strategy. You know, some of you young people are going up to camp, right? The big thing at camp is the zone, right? We're creating this zone, which is a place that we say is safe. So now we can build relationships which allow campers to what? Campers to self-reflect on how God can fit. That's what the zone's about. The zone is about allowing people enough safety, enough peace, enough space that they can reflect and now decide for themselves how God fits. That's what special music does. It lets us to reflect and think, well, how do we fit? How's that fit with me? How's that fit with the person I saw? How's that fit with my family? You know what I mean? We have to reflect. In our world today, you and I have very few opportunities to reflect. Okay, we're in the car, we think we're reflecting, but no, we're deflecting. Left brain, right brain. What did he do that for? I mean, it's really gotten worse, okay? Anyway, But we need techniques. We need techniques to actively listen inside the zone at camp or even here at church. These are not tricks. They are not mind games. They are focusing your interest on getting a real response. You know, we love it, right? We walk into church. Well, how was your week? Fine. Oh, was it really good? Yes. How was the flight? Great. I mean, it's not sufficient, right? And so we say to ourselves, okay, you know, now I realize most of you ladies, okay, who speak 45,000 words a day, okay, have no problem. I come home yesterday, Laurel is already sitting on the couch, she was about 20 minutes ahead of me, and I walk in the room and I said, so have you guys reached your 45,000 words yet? I know whether or not to interrupt. Her and Mom are sitting there and they're debriefing from the whole day, you know what I mean? I have to know when do I enter or not, okay? But they're getting real responses. And us men, perhaps we need more of the tips than the ladies. Okay, so we're going to talk once again today about three tips. Asking open-ended questions, labeling, and mirroring. Open-ended questions. They're calibrated on purpose. No one-word answers. I say, who are you? I'm Frank. Great. This conversation's going someplace fast, okay? You know, where are you from? Australia. It's a big place. Could be able to be a little more specific, you know? I mean, is it Tasmania? Is it Perth? Is it Port Douglas? You know what I mean? Alongside the ocean, blue, right? Very blue. The Great Barrier Reef, right? Okay. You know, when did you leave? The 22nd of August. You know what I'm saying? It's brief. We have to ask the questions differently. If I say, how was the drive to church with Mr. Brown at the wheel? Now there's a story, right? Right? You know, what was it like to watch Bill Grinnell in the Munich airport deal with his situation a few years ago? Well, his son will say, oh, wow, there's a story there, right? That's what you want. You see, do we ask a calibrated question? I'm not saying it's a trick. I'm saying it's a technique that we begin to apply, that we begin to express a true. If we love other people, we want to really know what they say. So, dear, how was your day? Well, and how works. How and what are critical, okay? Well, asking why questions are a big no-no, okay? Why is defensive, Mr. Voss puts out, as they dealt with this around the world, talking with their other international police agencies. They said asking a why question in almost any language, translated no matter how you want, is defensive. Why questions work in a sermon, in an article, because of a reason. In a sermon or article, it works because it creates a defensiveness that in supporting the change you're trying to get people to make. Why were you born was a booklet we had for years. We were trying to slap people across the face. Wake up in there. Why were you born? Okay? It's a defensive position for which you want somebody to get something constructive. But in interpersonal relationships, why is defensive? You see, even if I ask it nicely, why are we having hot dogs? Okay? Now, do you even, you just think about that. You come home and you say to your spouse, why are we having hot dogs? Even in the nicest way. So you were thinking that we should have hamburgers, steaks, or something else. You don't like the choices I've made. You don't understand that I went to 5 markets and nobody had hamburger meat today. I mean, there is no getting back from that, okay? It is not a good thing. For example, if I say to you, why are you attending here? Well, do you not want me? I mean, do you want me to leave? I can leave right now. I mean, my car's right there. It's accusatory. But if I say to you, how do you feel your school year went? It's more open-ended. If I say to you, how do we get Chad to feel more comfortable and included in our congregation? We have something to talk about. If I say, what activity at the feast excites you? Oh, you know, if you're at camp, you know, we say, well, what activities at camp are you afraid of? You know, you see somebody who's being reticent. You're trying to create this safety for them. This safety that, okay, you really want to listen. I mean, a lot of times we think listening is... No, we have to do more smile, more than smile. I mean, there is an activity which is, yes, you look at people, and that conveys a feeling. But why asking calibrated questions works is that it eliminates verbal combat. It provides tactical empathy because it says to the other person, I'm going to stop and really listen to you. When there's a conversation between two people, we need to understand one thing. There are four people talking. Okay? I'm talking to you right now. Okay? You're hearing what I'm saying. You're trying to decide if what I said was really funny, so you're trying to decide if you should respond. And I try to think, oh no, if they don't laugh, what am I going to say? That's four people talking at any one time. But a calibrated question makes you slow your brain down and listen and offer the opportunity to hear what the other person is saying. We don't need conversational combat. Did you ever have that? You know, some people say this and some people say this, and it's like a repartee, and you're going ping pong, ping pong. No, calibrate. Now, there's a great example of calibrated questions. Let's go to Jonah. In Jonah, there is this wonderful, wonderful account. We all know the account of Jonah, right? Jonah in belly in a whale. Jonah's running away from God. He doesn't want to deliver a message to Nineveh, right? But in Jonah chapter 1, we see something happen. Jonah gets in the boat. Okay, now, if you believe that God created the universe, you believe he's all-powerful and all those type of things, right? What happens? Well, God, I don't want to do what you have to say, so I'm going to get in a boat. It's like, okay, God says. I mean, I was like, all right, just a little boat on that sea. You know, which way do I want that boat to go? So here we go. Verse 8. So these guys in the boat, it's rough seas, rough as to say the least, and they said to him, please tell us. Now they're at Jonah, okay? Now watch the attitude of these questions, he says. Now these are rather accusatory at first. Notice, please tell us, for whose cause is this trouble come upon us? What's your occupation? Where do you come from? What's your country? And what of the people are you with? If this storm has anything to do with you, bud, bang, bang, bang. They want to know everything. They want the 411 and now. And he says to them, I'm a Hebrew. I fear the Lord God of heaven who made the sea and the dry land. And then the men were exceedingly afraid and said to him, what have you done to us? See, very accusatory. Because these people were believers. They believed that God was God. And they're like, Jonah, if you're running from the God that we know as God, we got big trouble. Why did you do this to us? Why did you get in our boat? Go to somebody else's boat, but not our boat. And proof that we don't like where we are is the sea is coming up over and down over the water. I mean, this is not a good thing. Why have you done this to us? For the men knew that he had fled from the presence of the Lord because he had told them, and they believed this. Now watch what happens. Watch how the tone changes and a calibrated question is asked. And then they said to him, what shall we do to you that the sea may be calm for us? For the sea was growing more tempestuous. And Jonah reveals the real scoop. See the calibrated question? What shall we do? And he says in verse 12, and he says to them, pick me up, throw me into the sea, and then the sea will be calm, for I know that this great tempest is because of me. Whoa. And now the guys don't like that answer. Verse 13, nevertheless, the men rowed harder to land, but they could not, for the sea continued to grow and be even more ferocious. Verse 14. And these men cried out to the Lord and said, we pray, O Lord, please do not let us perish for this man's life. Jonah's screwing up, and it's not our fault. I mean, when the waves are coming over the bow and the ship's going to sink, you get pretty honest and pretty real. These guys are not mincing words with God. But look, watch this. But they value life. Notice what they say. Please do not let us perish with this man's life, and do not charge us with innocent blood, for you, O Lord, have done it as you pleased you. Okay, God, he shouldn't be on the boat. We don't want to die. He says if we toss him over, it's going to calm down. So, okay, here we go, but don't put his life in our hands. And they toss him over. And the sea quiets down. So they picked him up, threw him in the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. When he hit the water, when he went down a foot, I got questions, okay? I got questions. How did that really work? I mean, I think it was pretty miraculous because it went, and just the wind stops and the waves stop. And just, okay, that worked. I hope, God, I hope it all works out. But it was a calibrated question to get Jonah to tell them what the real deal was. And so they asked it, and they got an answer. Now, I'll tell you another one. It's calibrated questions, and it's one of the great, great accounts of the Bible. Genesis chapter 18. Genesis chapter 18, you all know where I'm going. It is the incident of Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, there's nothing greater in a sermon than to be able to talk about fire, hell, and brimstone, right? So, but I'm not going to get into the fiery part today. I'm going to get into how we almost didn't have to get to the fire. If we start in Genesis chapter 18 and verse 16, remember, the Lord comes with some servants and have dinner with Abraham and Sarah. And in verse 16, and then the men rose up, it's after dinner, and looked towards Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham went with them to send them on their way, walk them out to the edge of the camp and see them on. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm going to do? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth will be blessed in him. God says, I've got a friendship with this guy. I didn't tell him the whole reason why I'm here. I think maybe I should tell him. What do you think, angel? And the angel says, yeah, go ahead. I think so. They're having this little report. Should we tell Abraham? Should we not? Should we tell? Don't. Should we? You can see, it's kind of like a comedy routine, but it's a little serious topic here. Verse 19. For I have known him in order that he may command his children and his household after him, and that they may keep the way of the Lord to do righteousness and justice, that the Lord may bring Abraham what he has spoken of him. It's interesting. They're talking about Abraham's faith, his capacity, his desire, his willingness to see righteousness flourish. And this is very important for us in the rest of the story. So notice God already has this view of Abraham, that Abraham loves life. He sees life. He knows life is going to come from him. He has a future. He, like us, we dream of what? The eternal life. We dream that all mankind will partake of knowing and walking and living with God, right? This is what we know. But now watch. And the Lord said, because of the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very, very grave, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it as it has come to me. And if not, I will know. And then the men turned away from there and went toward Sodom. But Abraham stood still before the Lord. You know, Abraham had kind of walked out with them. He's in front of them. You can see it on the edge of the Jordan River Valley. If we kind of know where Sodom and Gomorrah is, by the way, there's a great archaeological site that's right across from the Allenby Bridge between Jerusalem and Amman, and it's just across the Jordan River. And it's probably one of the most likely sites this group of archaeologists feel that is probably Sodom and Gomorrah. We hope to visit it next year. And anyway, it's under excavation, it's under consideration, but they've got a lot of evidence that makes them think it is. I don't know how much burnt stuff they have to find to know that, but we'll have to see. Anyway, it's interesting to see their logic and what they're doing, but anyway, a little side note there, sorry. Okay, so then the men turned away, and so Abraham's with them, and God goes to walk, and it goes, Abraham says, so did I just hear you right? You're going to go and see if the place my nephew's at, Lot, I know things have not been going over there, but it seems to me you're not real happy with it, and maybe something's going to happen that shouldn't happen. I don't want to see it destroyed. And so Abraham's standing there, and he still stood still. Verse 23. And Abraham came near. Abraham walks a little more towards God, the Old Testament, Jesus Christ, right? And he says to him, It's a calibrated question. Watch it. Would you also destroy the righteous with the wicked? This is the one who God views as the preserver of life, right? And God says, oh, okay, Abraham kind of has taken this whole discussion to heart, so this is fascinating to me, he says. So watch what he says. And so now another calibrated question, verse 24. Abraham says, suppose there were 50 righteous within the city. Would you destroy the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous who are in it? Calibrated. They're having a discussion. See what I mean? Abraham is after the real nub of the issue. If he asks it right, will he get the real story? See, he's trying to negotiate here. But he wants to, you know what? The importance of negotiation is you have to know what the black swan is. That's Mr. Voss's point is. In any situation, what there's something you don't know. Right? You don't know what their real cost point is. You don't know what's the point they will die or not go is. That's what you're looking for. And so Abraham's looking. There's a place where he knows that this is a no-go. Right? We had a no-go this week in international diplomacy, right? All right. So now, verse 24. So suppose there were 50. And Abraham says, for far be it from you to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous should be as the wicked. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? Ooh. I mean, Abraham's preaching to God? Well, see, but he understands. Well, God just said Abraham will be the father of the faithful and the righteous. Abraham will teach his children that God's a loving and caring and kind and forward-thinking person. And so Abraham says, well, wait a minute, his character is this. I know his character wants life. So I'm saying, how's all this work, God? Are we going to destroy the world for this many good ones or that many good ones? You know what I mean? I mean, interesting. So the Lord said, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, now I find it fascinating. This is great, right? Within the city. I mean, God says, now, so it's inside the city limits. So it's like, okay, if I find 50 righteous in the city of Los Angeles, and I'm not Abraham talking about the county of Los Angeles, which is much bigger than the city. I think they're having a real, you know what I mean, what the city limits, okay? Then I will spare all the place for their sakes. And Abraham answered and said, indeed, now I am who I am, but dust and ashes, and have taken it upon myself to speak. Now I know that this is probably a little outside my pay grade, but verse 28, another calibrated question. Suppose there were 5 less than the 50. Would you destroy it? All of the city for the lack of 5? Now notice, all the city, he's really pouring it on. Okay, it's a great thing here. I will not destroy it, says. And then he spoke to him yet again and said, suppose there should be 40 found there. And God says, I won't destroy it for 40. And then he said, Abraham, let not the Lord be angry. You know, I know you want $20,000 for that car, but, you know, my wife really... She's a real penny pincher. And, you know, I really can't justify paying more than $18,500. I mean, I just can't do it. You know what I mean? I mean, we got to put groceries. We got college to pay for. You can just hear it going back and forth. All right? There's a reason that Abraham had a lot of flocks. Okay? Anyway, so here you see it again. So suppose in verse 30, there should be 30. And in verse 31, and he said, indeed, now I've taken it upon myself to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 should be found. He says, I won't destroy it for 20. And in verse 32, he says, I'll speak only one more time. My last and final calibrated question. Suppose 10 should be found there. And he said, I will not destroy it for the sake of 10. And so the Lord went his way as he finished speaking with Abraham. You see, Abraham was negotiating for the lives of people. When we're talking to each other, do we think that we're negotiating to understand another Christian, another person's walk? It's active listening we're after. It's not hearing the words. It's not being distracted with other things. Ask calibrated questions. Ask how and what. If you feel like what I'm about to tell you will sound fake and weird, you're right. We need to label people's feelings to keep the conversation, the interaction going. So we've asked a how question. But you see, if you don't label the feelings after they've told you things, for example, if you're up at camp and you say, I hear you're good at archery. I see you like the color green. I heard you talking that it was a tough year in school. Those statements don't engender more. You see, you need to use three phrases. It looks like, it seems like, and it sounds like. I'll rephrase those. It seems like you have done archery before. It looks like you, the color green is one of your favorites. While it's really gaudy, but I see you like green. It sounds like you have had a tough year in school. You see, what you're after is this tactical empathy. You see, these things cause you and I to incite in the other person even more and more empathy. Labels, their power invites the other person to reveal themselves because you've identified that you really are listening. There's a big thing that has to happen after this, though. When you say it seems like, it looks like, it feels like, you have to do something that's counterintuitive. You have to just pause. Say nothing. It has to hang there. It looks like you like the color green. Oh, yes. And my mother and I went and picked it out. And you ladies who are counselors are going, oh, so mom helped you pick out that dress. Okay, that conversation's going to go a little different. You know what I mean? Okay, you know, it doesn't quite fit the rules for camp, but her mother helped her pick it out. Ouch. You need more information. She would have seen, that's the black swan. You know what I mean? Did we really think that they went shopping all by themselves? No. But just looking at it, we're like, you can't wear that. It doesn't take us anywhere. We need calibrated questions. We need labeling, which allow us and give us time to understand. And time to understand helps us negotiate a different outcome. Go over with me to Philemon. In Philemon, we find a label used. Paul's writing to send Philemon back. Not Philemon, he's talking to send Onesimus back, who's the slave, right? Who's run away from Philemon. And picking up the story, and it's Philemon, which is right before Hebrews, page 1713. No, that won't help you, will it? Now, this is where electronic people get to the scripture much faster, because you just go, oh, P-H-I-L-M, oh, yeah, there it is, you know, and you got it. Okay, verse 8. Therefore, oh, I know, I want to skip down. We're going to go to verse 10. He says, I appeal to you for my son Onesimus, whom I have begotten while in chains, who once was unprofitable to you, but now is profitable to you and to me. I'm sending him back. You therefore receive him, that is, my own heart, whom I wish to keep with me, that on your behalf he might minister to me in my chains for the gospel. But without your consent, I wanted to do nothing, that your good deed might not be by compulsion, as it were, but by voluntary. And here comes the labeling. Paul's not able to have a one-on-one conversation. So in this letter, he's negotiating for a safe, viable, meaningful return of a slave. Everything's on the table here. Paul's trying to make it all right in a territory that they didn't know how they were going to make this work, right? You've got a Christian. Philemon is a Christian. He owns a slave who runs away, who Paul really can't keep without the owner's permission. Okay? And he doesn't have the papers, and I've got to send him back. And how's this Christian going to receive another Christian who's still a slave? This is new territory. And Paul's trying to navigate it. But watch how he labels these feelings. Verse 15. For perhaps, we could say, in some translations, a few, it says, it seems. For perhaps he departed for a while for this purpose, that you might receive him forever. Paul labels the feelings he knows Philemon will have. He says, so it seems as if he departed for a while for this very purpose, that he would be converted, that I would be with him, that now he could come back to you, and he could come back to you in the role of, yes, a servant, yes, a slave, but also a Christian brother. Can I elevate you to think about this? Paul labels, it seems like, it looks like, it sounds like. Empathy, active listening. You see, we are not about, in a conversation, sympathy. Sympathy is, I agree with you. Sympathy is, oh, I too do not like green beans. Oh, my, they're terrible. What did our mothers ever do about making us eat green beans? They're the worst vegetable. And if that's how you feel, that's okay, right? I mean, you can have sympathy. But in a conversation, you're about empathy. You're about, the agreement is not our goal in a conversation. It is not about our approval. When we label, it seems like, it sounds like, it looks like, we don't have to own their feelings. We don't have to own their trouble. It seems like that was really difficult. See, we're not evaluating like, well, you really screwed up. No wonder they're mad at you. It sounds like that was a difficult situation. It looks like that's going to take a while to work out. It seems like, it looks like, it sounds like. Approval is not our goal. Connection is, because with connection, we get new results. But remember, it seems like, it looks like, it feels like needs a pause afterwards. The big pause, because then people are gravitated towards it. Now, number three, of all the FBI techniques, Chris Voss says the FBI learned in the 80s, the 90s. He says this one is the most Jedi-like, the most trick-like that there is, because it works. That's why. It's called mirroring. It's golden. It's the pièce de résistance. It's the perfect one. This helps voice, the voice in your head, quiet down and listen to the other person and bond. Get in sync and establish rapport that leads to real trust. Mirroring is, in the technical terms, isopraxism. It's imitation. You see speech patterns, body language, vocabulary, tempo, tone of voice. Mirroring invites elaboration. You've heard people who walk up and you're talking to somebody and you're like this. There's a wall, right? There's a wall between. They say it's incredible. And you put your hands down. You lean in. And not only talking about you're doing it for the wrong reason. You're doing it because you want to tell the other person. How many times do you reach over and you touch the other person's hand, if you're a touchy-feely person, and you go, okay, I'm with you. You know what I mean? Why? You're not trying to interrupt the flow. You just realize the person's, you know, having a bad day. You reach over. You want to offer some empathy. And what do? You touch them and you go, okay, I'm with you. Why? You're also trying to make sure you are with them. You want to be in sync yourself. Mirroring is this. You pause and you say the last three words that they said. Or thereabouts. You got to get after the item that they're really talking about. I want to show you how Jesus uses mirroring in a magnificent way. Turn with me to Luke. In Luke 24, it's after the resurrection. And remember, Jesus told them after the resurrection, you know, stay. You know, I want you to be around. And he realizes that some of the folks are going north. They're going the wrong direction. Okay? we need to keep the nucleus here. So I don't know whether an angel came and got Christ and said, hey, I don't know what's going on, but chapter 24, about verse 13. Now behold, two of them were traveling that same day to a village about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They're going home to Galilee. And Jesus goes, no, we got to get them back. We need the group in Jerusalem. I can't be going running back and forth to Galilee. I mean, I can go at the speed of light. I know that, but it's going to be a little easier if I get them all in the same place. And so these disciples all walked together, and they talked about all that had happened during the crucifixion. And so it was, while they had conversed and reasoned, that Jesus himself drew near, and he went with them. But their eyes were restrained, and they didn't know it was him. And he said to them, what kind of conversation is that you have one with another as you walk and are sad? And one of them whose name is Cleophas answered and said to him, are you the only stranger in Jerusalem? Have you not known the things which happened these days? And Jesus offers the perfect mirror. Watch what happens. And he said to them, what things? He mirrored them. And then he paused. And watch what happens over the next five verses. And they said to him, the things concerning Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty indeed, word in God before all the people, how the chief priest, our rulers, delivered to me to commit to condemn to death. He was thus crucified. We were hoping that he was going to be the redeemed of Israel. Instead, besides all this day, it's the third day and things still haven't happened. Yes, and then a bunch of our women, they went out in the company to the tomb, and they astonished us, and they said, his body's not there. What are we to think of now? I mean, these guys just poured forth. It was like the whole script, just verse 24. And certain of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as he said. And now Jesus is thinking to himself, you heard all that, and you're going the wrong direction? And then the rest of the story is Jesus interacts with them and they begin to realize it's him, etc. But Jesus mirrored and he paused and waited for them to talk. You know, there's a great study done by, I'm sorry, Mr. Budge, another institution in Los Angeles over on the west side, UCLA. Now, in defense, I'm not talking about the medical school. So I'm talking about the college, that's okay. But UCLA, Albert Mehrabian, they did a study on communication. And they said, the communications value in life, 7% is the words, 38% is our tone, and 55% is body language. Mirroring brings together tone and body language. It gets you all the way home inside the situation. So if you've asked a calibrated question, you've labeled it seems like, it sounds like, it looks like, and you paused. And then there are times when you just need to use a mirror and say, that was a ride? You have to ask a question. Sometimes you might even have to ask it twice. That was a ride. People are drawn to their own words, their own feelings, and now they will tell you more. Now, does this all take practice? Yes. For example, in camp, on opening night, you might have to be able to ask some calibrated questions, right? Well, what was it like this last year? How? But not why are you here? That doesn't work. It's accusatory. How about first-time visitors to church? How about being in a new job, in a new school, new people? These are situations where people feel uncomfortable. People are unfamiliar. Will they like me? That's the big thing at camp. Are they going to like me? You imagine we have somebody new come in to church. Are they going to like me? People want to be liked. People want to belong. And we have to go and bring them in. We have to draw them in. Oh, do you know so-and-so? Do you know so-and-so? It seems like you might look a little lost. It's your first time to L.A. Yeah, it's a big city. We're a little cliquish here. We only like new people about after the third year or something. You know? Well, you know what I'm saying? I mean, we all have been this new someplace. So how's it work? We might say, let us craft some questions together. Sometimes, you know, you have to prepare for certain things. What? You might say, how about a new person coming to church? What is the most interesting part of the Bible? They're going to answer, and maybe you have to mirror eventually and say, Ruth? Or maybe you say, Nabal? Why would you like that scoundrel? You know what I mean? But I'm saying, you know what I mean? You hear the story, mirror it. Or how do you see yourself fitting in this year at camp? Wow. How do you see yourself fitting in at church? Oh, you really want to run the soundboard? Wow. Or what do you see as a way you can help others in our church congregation? Active listening? Yes. How do you see church experience helping you see God more clearly? Bearing up others' burdens? I gave you the chart, and one of the things on the chart I think you'll find, it's just fascinating, is we had it out this morning at the house. This is always dangerous on before you give a sermon, you know. My wife, the editor, and my daughter, the editor. Actually, this is pretty good. I only had to change two words on this page, okay? Only had to add one and delete one. Okay, anyway, so that was good. Anyway, but I mean, what's fascinating is you look at the chart, there are personality types that gravitate towards each other, and there are personality types that don't. And so I hope the chart gives you a little room for thought, how people see themselves and how you see them are entirely different, right? Sometimes we think some people are just so active and so outgoing, and yet we realize their talking is because they're nervous as all get out, and they don't think you're going to like them at all, and they just keep talking, and we don't know what to say, but it goes, it's like, would you just shut up? We like you. It's okay. Just take the shot. Just take the shot, right? That's all we want. But mirroring works like a Jedi, he says. What's fascinating, as you look down the chart, notice the view of silence. If somebody's shy, i.e. an analyst, if you would, they need time to think. Sometimes we think that people who are taking time to answer, that we have to fill in. Because you see, if they were the accommodator, we just keep on talking. And the more talking we have, the more it'll be due. You know, sometimes you just have to, and that's the value of asking a calibrated question. That's the value of labeling and pausing. You force yourself to wait for them to answer, and they're shy, and they say, I got to answer this person. I don't know whether I'm going to say it right, because if I say it wrong, they'll think I'm stupid, but I'm really not stupid, but I'm really, really smart. And they said I should do this, and I'm going to reply, and then I'm about to reply, and they just start talking. If you just waited another 4 seconds. And so their view of silence, those people need time to think. If you realize that, you see, if you realize you're pausing because you're giving them time to think, you're not pausing to trick them, you're pausing because, I need time to think sometimes too. You know what I mean? Or how about the assertive person? They view silence as an opportunity to talk more. That was a big topic of discussion at our house this morning, because I talk a little more. But I don't think so. See, I think I only talk about 17,000 words a day. Maybe I'll go to 22. But ladies, you talk 45,000 words a day. And I don't think I've quite approached that. Anyway. But that's not what everybody says. Everybody says I talk a little too much, right? I see Donna out there. I don't know whether she's a little at the office. You know what I mean? I try not to talk too much. Anyway. Or notice how the accommodator views silence. They view silence as they may have done something wrong. See what I'm saying? We need to really actively listen. We need to think about the other person. And thinking about the other person is loving the other person. It's really reaching out in an empathetic way, which is real and tangible. So is it any wonder if we turn back to James chapter 1:19? James 1:19, how's he say it? James has come to see something, you know, in the practical side of life. Here's how he viewed it. He says, you know, after living a while, you realize this. Verse 19, so then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear. Be an active listener, asking calibrated questions, labeling, pausing, and sometimes mirroring to get more out of the situation. And thus you become slow to speak. And thus, a great outgrowth of that is sometimes you become slow to wrath because you've gotten the whole story before you really blew your top. Asking calibrated questions, help us show godly love, help us have empathy, not sympathy, not agreement, with other people. And they allow us to negotiate life, to engender our congregations, our campers and people, like our lives depended on it. Because it does. Because we're following God. So then, my friends, let us be swift to actively listen.